I might just kick off with a question to start with Robin. Robin, you talked about the courageous and strong women that supported you, both in terms of growing up, but also in your endeavours from business leader to community leader. Can you talk a bit about where you see, I guess, the role of Indigenous and female leaders in the success with regards to our workforce and also with what we need to do to continue to see women shine as leaders?
Thank you, yes. So I guess, as I mentioned in my speech and my talk, we have an incredible host of Aboriginal women who are very well suited to step into many different spaces and places within the workforce. You know, we've got women, as I said, from all walks of life and background who bring a vast amount of knowledge and experience. You know, we know how to work as a team. We understand about hard work and determination. We understand about that connect, which then can make us, you know, really good team players as well and team members. So I absolutely think that there's a place, a very big place, for Aboriginal women to now be standing and taking their positions in business, corporate, government. We have a lot of women doing a lot of amazing things. And through our organisation, WALI, we have a great support network in there that continues to grow and develop the women that come through our programs. We have an emerging leaders program that we're piloting at the moment, and we have young women and men in there, but we are preparing them to just continue on this leadership journey. So I guess, yes, I had some amazing role models in my life and continue to have them, and we all stand together and support each other. The 150 women that have gone through our program, that alumni is so strong, they gather regularly, they continually support each other, and it's really important to have those people that you can turn to support you in the journey.
Thank you. I'm going to try and do this in a clunky way and read the questions off, but the next one, Prue's for you. So thank you for sharing your journey. I remember you talking to me earlier and saying, I don't have the fun or the good story, I've got the bad story. And I think the bad story is even better for us to learn from and share your experience.
Well, it's the truth.
So, Prue, do you still find yourself downplaying your differences to make others feel more comfortable?
Probably not, because, look, I have the benefit with my disability of it being very obvious. So it's pretty, the minute you look at me, it's no question that I have a disability. So I have that, I think, as a benefit, as opposed to what we call an invisible disability. So, you know, hearing impaired, visually impaired, mental health issues. So I kind of don't really see the point in playing it down because, you know, it's obvious that there are differences. I also, this didn't sound terrible, but I'm not here on this planet to be everyone's life lesson. I'm just doing my thing and getting through life in the best way that I can do that. So if I'm going to be honest, which I am frighteningly good at, if that doesn't sit well with some people, or I can't help that, you know? And I think downplaying, you know, issues such as the ones that I've faced, I'm not doing anyone a service. Mm. I'm diminishing the challenges that I've had, and in my view, therefore, also diminishing the challenges that other people in my position have, and I just don't see that as a benefit. So no, I don't.
Well, thank you. Sharon, this one's for you, but obviously open to all. What kind of advice can you give, well, they're quickly changing in front of me, can you give to lead a majority female workplace to encourage, to innovate and depart from the colonial morning tea culture that you talked about?
Oh dear, the morning tea.
That'll be written on Twitter tomorrow, I'm sure.
What was the question? What advice?
To innovate, encourage to innovate from a departure from the colonial morning tea culture.
So I just kind of encourage, I mean, morning teas are good for lots of reasons, and we should celebrate and we should come together and recognise and provide visibility for all the great things and for the challenge for the future. But I suppose my key message is, if that's all we do, then I think we'll pretty much stick with the same situation that we have now. So I'm interested in sort of digging deeper into and getting discussion around digging deeper into the sort of structural underpinning changes that might need to happen. But I think it's slow, small steps. It's trying to think of bigger levers, perhaps, that might have change in your workplace, asking different sorts of questions. The why question, why is it like it is? Rather than trying to fiddle around at the margins, which isn't really a very concrete, practical answer for you, but it's keep digging down into the question, why is it like that? Well, because it's always been like that, but why does it have to be like that? And I'm trying to do that at the Public Sector Commission, which is historically kind of known for, I think, not burying, but making some of these issues so complex that it's hard for people to get a handle on. And we're trying to find concrete strategies ourselves for the Commission, but also for the sector. So we're all confronting the same issue about how do you get beyond that superficial acknowledgement. And so my first answer to that question is just keep asking why, and why not.
Mm. Very good. Perhaps a question, and happy for any to answer, but where does ageism sit in this, especially faced in an economic downturn with the COVID situation? So where do you see ageism playing in this debate?
I'll just start from a COVID perspective, given I'm a bit involved in that. So you'd all know that youth are one of the biggest affected groups, and our concern is, will they be the ones that pick up the terrific job generation that's happening, particularly here in Western Australia? So, the people affected, Aboriginal people, young people and women in particular, and a lot of the jobs at the moment will be in infrastructure. Mm. And so, will there be a good match? And so no one sector can do that on its own. And so the ageism question, I think, is real and front and centre as I go around in my kind of COVID recovery work. That's what we're hearing about, the concerns about youth, but the concerns of people who've been tipped out of work, who are perhaps older, and their capacity to come back into the workforce in meaningful work is certainly, I'm just echoing the sentiment of the question, is that it's a real live issue that people are bringing forward. And again, it comes back to that kind of openness of recruitment and looking for some difference of thought and experience and background. And sometimes older people, many times older people have a lot of that to offer.
I think not so much from the disability side of things, but from my work as a family lawyer, my experience with women and ageism is, very, if you get your 1950s couple, husband, wife, two children, wife stays home, does the child rearing, the amount of, and your husband goes off to work. Now, the amount of women that I've had to sort of help and try and assist have sort of gotten to, the kids are say 15 and 18, the marriage has fallen apart, so they're maybe 50 something. Who's going to employ these women? Nobody. Because they've been out of the sector of any employment for a good 20 years. And already women, in my view, are having enough trouble as it is. And then added to the fact that they're, past their prime. Mm. And the problem, once you've got a financial settlement between a couple, that's it. You're not, the husband doesn't have to keep supporting you unless you've got a good case, and that's a whole other conversation. but, that's it. You now really are on your own to financially keep a roof over your head. So I think that's a huge issue for women in Australia and WA.
Really good. Thanks. Thanks, Prue and Sharon. Perhaps one for Robin in terms of how do we approach the multitudes of diversity inequity we face? All equity areas do matter, and it's difficult to promote the specific cohorts, whether we look at all of the different issues around inequity. How do you, what advice do you give in terms of how you manage that and how you advocate, but also think about that from a strategic perspective in your business?
It's a good question, and I will focus on you know, the Aboriginal side, because that's where my specialty is, that's where everything lies for us. I guess, can you just repeat your question again? Sorry.
So I think just with the multitudes of different challenges with diversity, and you know, how do you make sure that you're, I guess, building your strategy to focus on all of those, whether it's females, Aboriginal employment, leadership?
Yep, sure. So, I mean, I spoke about a lot of it in my talk earlier on my speech. We have been catching up for a long time. Mm. We have a very young population. So, you know, the life expectancy for Aboriginal people is you know, 10 to 12 years younger, depending on the gender. So a lot of our focus is around, I guess, getting our young people through, looking after our old people. And we have this amazing organisation that does what it does. There are incredible people in our community who are doing their part. And I guess that's what, you know, what's so nice about being here today to speak to you all, is to be able to share some of the stories mm-hmm. about how we are actually working through, you know, those diversity issues. There needs to be more Aboriginal people, Aboriginal women, Aboriginal people in general in the space. We need to be seen and we need to be heard. And that's all the things that we're hopefully working towards. Times have definitely changed, but there's still a lot more that needs to happen. There's change happening and a lot of work to be done. But as I said, we've got some great people who work with us, you know, our non-Aboriginal people. And that's why I put out the request today, or the plea to, you know, people in positions of power, don't hesitate to take up. You know, take up the baton and do what you can to continue to empower our people and put us into places where we can make decisions, and certainly make decisions about ourselves. And that's been a big shift. Mm. We are now in a place where culturally, and our connect to this place, people are starting to listen. You know, open your hearts, open your heads, and listen. Listen to what we have to say about where we go and how we go about it.
Absolutely.
Just to add into that, because I'm sure it's the same for other organisations, and building on what Robin was saying, our diversification plan that we put out for the public sector has six action plans representing the six subgroups that we want to you know, assist come forward in our work. And public sector agencies rightfully said to us, well, that's a lot of extra work if you see it as extra work. You know, there's a lot of work there, you know, several hundred initiatives, six lots of targets, you know, extraordinary amount of work. But how we tried to approach it is, in a lot of those six groups that across the six groups we're looking at, a lot of the actions are very similar. A lot of them just start from a basic respect and, you know, talking with people and understanding what they need in the workplace, and how we might approach, as I said before, recruitment. So there's a lot of similarity. There's obviously difference, and that ought to be respected. But, you know, when you sort of see it as a burdensome lot, then you're probably starting from the wrong place. Right. But there's a lot of commonality in how to approach bringing you know, greater diversity into the workplace, I think.
I think I've spoken to both of you around, you know, how do we make it easier for the next generation? And, you know, we're talking about how we've been doing some work in my team about understanding why women retention is an issue, and what's making people, you know, not want to stay or go. And that feeling that there's favouritism or there's preferential treatment, or that it's hard. Can you both share, I guess, your story about how you're making it easier for the next generation of you?
Oh dear. However, just to go back to the point you were making, Prue, first thing is, when I was in charge of education, if I'd stayed longer, which probably wouldn't have been good for anyone, one thing I would have wanted to do is teach young women about financial independence. Mothers in the room, keep it in mind, very important for young women and young men, but particularly young women, to learn about financial independence. So what are we doing in the workplace to bring, you know, young people forward? First thing, just spending time with young women and speaking with them, and being honest, actually, about what they need perhaps, you know, the areas that they might like to work in, that we would like them to grow and develop in. I don't think, you know, performance management is generally all that helpful to people because very often it's not particularly honest. I think people skirt around the issues. Mm. And so, you know, being honest about the kind of competencies that are needed, helping them be visible, I think I was saying to Di or might have been you earlier, you know, about helping young women be visible in the workplace, because at the moment around recruitment there is that familiarity and people are comfortable with people that they know something about. So, so we do a bit of that visibility. We move people around. Sonia O'Leary, that's here, who's my chief advisor around diversity. We do that even today in her team, having people, you know, different young women coming into that team and taking leadership roles. So I think it's personalising it would be one message that I would give. You actually have to, as a leader, get out there and do it and not just tell everyone, but do some of it yourself.
I think for us, one of the things we do with our young people when they come into our program is point out to them that they already are leaders. They're already taking up leadership roles in their families, in their community. They already have that responsibility before they even step into the workforce. So I guess for us, we build a lot of our programs around that cultural empowerment and cultural authority from our elders. Our elders are very much revered and respected in the community, and the space that they actually hold for us and for our young people is something that you can't even put a price on. Mm. And it's that guidance and that leadership that they give to the young ones that I think is a great encourager. And we always say to them, take up any opportunity that comes along. Step out of your comfort zone, be brave, and we're here to support them. So,
Prue, you talked a bit, and there's a question here around unconscious bias and, you know, how can we challenge our hiring managers and people who are looking at us for who we are, and unconscious bias. And you shared some stories about people that come in to get advice from a family law perspective and their backgrounds. Can you talk to us a bit about your thoughts about, you know, how do you encourage and what you would, you know, do in your practice, but also from a leadership perspective to really challenge that unconscious bias?
Yeah, unconscious bias is an interesting little nugget, isn't it? Just as a complete aside, I remember one of the many job interviews that I went to in my career. I went in and there was a gentleman, I think he was a sole practitioner, and we were literally shaking hands, and as he was shaking my hand, he said, "Oh, my wife was in a wheelchair for 2 years before she died." Literally the first sentence, and I just was like, I don't know what to do with that. Sorry to hear. Yeah, I did not get that job. So in terms of unconscious bias, in terms of, you know, like the interview process, which I think is the most applicable thing here, because that really is, you know, where we're looking with employment. It's, again, for me, it's about education of the people that are employing. Mm. So again, and I'd sound like a crack record, but, like, I don't know that many people in this room have met a person in a wheelchair like me. I certainly haven't come across. Look, I do disability discrimination work, and it's rare that the people that come through my door have the capacity to self-rep like I do, have their own advocacy skills. So all I'm asking and all I think needs to happen is, I get it, I do the same thing. I see, you know, an individual of a certain look, and I admit, we all do it. I go, oh, that person must be like that because of how they look. Mm. And I think that's human nature, and I think that we have to go, okay, that's fine, that's my first reaction, but my higher educated self knows, well, hang on, yes, that's how they look, but I haven't had a single conversation with this person. I don't know what their capacity for expressing themselves is like. I don't know whether I need assistance through an Auslan interpreter or, you know, or a visual aid or anything like that to communicate with this person. But here's the clincher. If someone is going for a job interview or applying for a job with a disability, chances are they are armed with the tools already to help the person in front of them deal with them. So again, it's get rid of the assumptions, just almost like a, how can I help you? Mm. What can we do? How can we work together? Because I guarantee it, every single person that comes before you with a disability that wants a job, it's not their first rodeo. And they know how to go about it. So I think that it's, again, just stop thinking what you know what it is and ask.
Yeah. Excellent advice. Fantastic. Sharon, mate, this one's, a more direct question for you, but perhaps in the broader terms of how, I guess, female leaders are judged when things go wrong or not as well as they should. So do you think Christine Holgate was treated more harshly because she was a woman leader? And perhaps just give your perspective in the public eye whether women are treated more harshly. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I think she was treated harshly because she bought people $15,000 watches. Just saying. I don't know. I mean, I administer part of the CCC Act, so I'm very attuned to gifts and benefits, of which my view, and it's evolved over time. I think, you know, Di and I were talking about this earlier. You know, things have evolved over time, but I'm talking public sector now, but it might be more appropriate to everyone. We get paid to do a job. We don't need to be given other things on top of that. In fact, our position is that it's inappropriate now. So I think she gets paid an amount of money to do her job, so do her people. I think we have to find other ways to acknowledge people for the public servants in the room. You know, it's the hard-earned tax dollars of people labouring out on the streets and workplaces that pay our wages, and I think that's enough. None of you will be getting a watch anytime soon, is what I'm saying. So I don't think she was judged more harshly because she was a woman. I think she was judged because, in my view, it was an inappropriate judgment call on her behalf.
Perhaps more for the panel and to share, you know, your thoughts, but how do you best address the regular statements in the workplace that men are feeling left out or left out in terms of, you know, when we're focusing on hiring targets or promotion opportunities? How do you... You're ready
to go
through.
Cry me a river, mate. Cry me a river.
In general agreement, I think, from the panel.
Our standard line is boo-hoo. Yep.
Well, that says it all, I think. Very good. Views, I guess, then in a similar vein on gender targets, or, you know, obviously, you know, the Public Commission has released a number of targets, but views on targets as a way to drive outcomes, and I guess both in terms of the results, but also the cultural shift that we want to see in our workplaces.
Just quickly on the target issue, I get their intention and I get the hope that they're going to achieve what people intend them to achieve. My concern around the target thing is the checkbox headspace. So literally, okay, we've got to have, say we've got a workforce of 1,000. So we've got to have, say, 2 people with a disability. All right, we'll stick one of them in that role and we'll stick one of them in that role. Tick, tick, done. Same with the gender thing. We have to have 40% women. All right, great, we'll stick them in. And I just don't see that as a positive environment to employ people. Like, I think, and look, don't get me wrong, I'm not the expert. These guys are much better at this than me, but tick boxing for me is pointless. It's like sticking someone in a position and then just leaving them there and going, well, we've done our quota, now we're fine. That is not an inclusive and diverse workplace. And all that's going to create is disharmony amongst the staff, you know, and I don't like them. I get their intention. I don't think they're a positive way to fix it, but I also don't have an answer on how to fix it, so sorry.
No, thanks, Prue. Sharon or Robin, any thoughts?
Yeah, I guess I've had an experience throughout my working life of being placed into a position where it was definitely, you know, ticking the box, and it was a pretty horrendous experience because I got into that that job, and you know, the only woman of colour in the whole place, and the job was not exactly what I thought it was going to be, and it was a really, really difficult space to be because I don't think anyone in the organisation had actually done any work in preparation or any education around and had even thought, or it wasn't, you know, a business imperative for them to consider what comes, you know, with around education and the diversity and inclusion piece. So, yeah, I agree. I don't have an answer either, but, you know, being there.
And for me, I've never wanted to be in a job because I made up someone's numbers or a target. In fact, I find it, like, riling that would be the suggestion. And then on the other hand, now we have targets, and so I have to reconcile that with myself. I think if the only thing you do is a target, you're going to come up short every time, because as these guys have said, you can achieve a target by, you know, popping a few diversity groups in at low-level jobs, which is, you know, just, in my view, worse than ignoring. So at the lowest common denominator, targets, I think, can by themselves be ineffectual and actually offensive. So it has to be part of a broader strategy to drive some change, I think, and has to be done in concert with other strategies. And, you know, one of the things that we're looking at, I think we call it Equity Index, where we look at every agency, and we're now publishing a dashboard for all agencies, which I think they're really enjoying, which looks at not only the diversity percentage, but at what levels of the organisation they are, and we then can, and I challenge where the people are ending up. It's not good enough for everyone to be from diversity groups to be in the lower order. So I think, you know, other interventions, other activities, accountability, you know, I've put it in Director General's performance agreements. They'll have to report on it as alongside targets as a driver for change. But we wouldn't need targets if we could all do the kumbaya thing and, you know, get it right. Apparently we can't. And so some rough end of the pineapple strategies like targets sometimes have to be brought into bear.
Sharon, I'm with you, and I think the discussion around, you know, Prue, I have the visceral reaction you have to targets as well, but I've also learned through my career that they drive behaviours, which mean that people look harder, you know, they actually have to do things differently to generate the results, so it's a really hard topic. I think we're up for the panel, and just to say a massive thank you to all of the speakers today, just incredibly impressed. I'll go home tonight to my daughter and talk about three amazing women that I've met today and the work that they're doing across a range of fields to make, you know, what is going to be a better world and a better place to live and work for the next generation to come. So thank you all very much, and I'll hand back Diane.
Thank you.